Well, hello, superstars, and welcome back to another episode of Word Up with Danny Katz. Today, I am joined by me. We are solo podcasting on a beautiful, gray, rainy day in my segment of planet Earth, realm Earth. I don't want to go offending those who question the shape of the planet. Before we dive into today's podcast, I am reminding you to click that subscribe button. To like, to share, to comment. I'm not saying these things just to hear myself speak. If you could literally maneuver your digits and your mouse or your trackpad so that you're literally clicking the subscribe button and clicking the thumbs up, that would be so great. Thank you so much. I get so much wonderful, validating, supportive feedback from you guys by way of email. And as we get to have that same validation and support reflected in the algorithmic nudging, I don't know, signifiers, like subscribing and liking, that would be wonderful. Also, as you are listening to today's podcast on any of the audio podcast platforms, thank you for leaving me a glowing 5-star review. And as you have read any of my books, The Language of Betterarchy, Word Up, Pop Propaganda, Yes, I Am, and found any value in any of them, thank you for navigating on over to Amazon and leaving me some glowing reviews. There, you. Yes, you, your efforts can go such a long way in nudging my content into the eyes, ears, and hearts of more and more humans. So thank you so much for your support. As well, I am coming to you today fortified with the Brain Supreme Genius Blend, which is one of my very favorite neurologically optimizing supplements. So, as you are someone who likes to supplement to shift your mood, to click into genius mode, to amp up your performance on the racquetball court, at the gym, on your yoga mat, do use the link in the show description to take you on over to Brain Supreme. And please also use the discount code, which will get you a nice little bit of savings with your every Brain Supreme order. And as long as I have us here, I am going to include the code in the show notes. And as you are listening with your ears and not yet ready to navigate there, the code is Word Up, all one word, all caps, WORDUP, gets you 50% off anything and everything that you order from Brain Supreme. Make that 15% off. Oopsie. Okay. That does it for housekeeping. Let us dive into today's show. So, hi, how's it going? I'm recording this on a Thursday. I guess it's the Thursday before Thanksgiving. And I have some actual topics today, but I did want to share that Thursday night I went to dinner with some friends and I saw Stephen Jenkinson in the restaurant. Now, if you don't know, if you're new to my podcast, I have interviewed Stephen Jenkinson twice on the Word Up podcast. Once was on his perspectives and experience around death, and once was on his latest book, Matrimony. So, after I interviewed him the first time about death, because I was such a fan girl, not because, there's no link there. That was an errant because. Throw that away. I happened to be a pretty massive fangirl when I interviewed Stephen the first time. And after our interview, I think it was less than a week later that he was in New Mexico performing one of his Nights of Grief and Wisdom. And forgive me if I'm mangling the title, but something along those lines, where he does his spoken word performance along with a band. And the show was awesome. And after the show, there was a long line of people with various, with their own copies of Stephen's books, and they were waiting to get an autograph, to say hello, to get some eye contact validation, something. And I opted out of introducing myself and going into that line for a couple reasons. So, one, I'd interviewed him for about an hour and a half a week before, and I recognize that when people are famous, whether they're famous for their writing, their spiritual teaching, their singing, their fake civil servitude, like it doesn't matter what it is, fame has this, I don't know, effect on where people want something from the famous people. They want eye contact, they want recognition, they want a picture, they want an autograph. There's kind of like, the way I envision it is like this pulling or taking from those who have that fame thing. So I felt like, I just had an hour and a half interview with him. I don't want to be greedy. I would like all these other people who are in line to connect with him to have that opportunity. The other piece is that I notice in that it's like, I feel like when, I was gonna say when famous people do, I don't know, their public offerings, they're being very generous. But the reason I stopped myself is because what popped into mind was when I saw Lenny Kravitz in concert in the 90s, and it was literally the worst concert I'd ever seen because he was too cool for school. He was just way too arrogant for his own good. So he wasn't actually generous with the audience. It was like he was God's gift to all of us, even though we paid for tickets, even though I didn't pay for a ticket because I went with Tracy Feldstein because her dad was in the music industry and she got tickets to everything. But it did feel like disrespectful to my and our collective sacred attention. So I'm not going to say all celebrities are generous with that stuff. And then there's also the like, is it a clone? Is it a hologram? Like, is it an MK Ultra altar? Like, whatever. But in general, I feel like here's what I'm thinking of. I'm thinking of both Stephen Jenkinson and Tom Robbins when Tom Robbins did his B is for beer thing in LA with Ben, whatever his name was. And I felt like, okay, these famous people are showing up and sharing of their gifts and vision with the audience. And then afterwards, people line up because they want more. They want an autograph. They want kind words. And I just feel like it just feels like it's too much to ask, which is why when I saw Tom Robbins at B is for Beer, I gifted him my Yes, I Am coloring book. And I feel like in those instances, it's more polite to give something to the famous people than to ask for more of them when they've just performed. So that was how I felt when I saw Steven after our first interview. So for our second, oh wait, let me give you one other piece. The other reason why I didn't introduce myself at that event is because I'm a little weary from experience of meeting my so-called heroes and then having them disappoint, as all humans do, right? It's just like whatever projections I have been cultivating and then thrust upon these people who I totally don't know. And then to have said famous person like be a dick, or say something that's going to shatter my illusions. I was like, you know what? I lost a lot of heroes with the FOVID thing. I lost a lot of heroes just with life. If you haven't heard my Robert Thurman story, and I'm not going to bore you with that, but like I lost Robert Thurman after Trump was elected the first time, and he's like spewing all this hate. And I'm like, what about right speech, Mr. Foremost Tibetan scholar, teacher in the country? But anyway, I didn't want to meet him and have any illusions of like his, perceived projected perfection to be obliterated in the face of his inconvenient humanity. However, that did or did not show up in the moment. So when I interviewed him the second time, which was over the summer, might have been spring, but no, I believe it was summer right after Matrimony came out. I told him the story of how, like, well, I saw you at this event right after our interview, but I didn't hear all the reasons why I didn't introduce myself. And he, very humbly, like, kind of waved them away and is like, no, it's, part of the course, introduce yourself. So when I saw him at dinner Thursday night when I was with my friends and he walked in, I immediately went, oh, because I think that happens, at least for me, when I see famous people. And this used to happen growing up in LA where it's like, I recognize that person. Did we go to summer camp together? Did we go to school together? Were we in gymnastics together? Or are they famous? I'm just not placing them. So when I first saw him walk into the restaurant, I was like, oh, because I thought I knew him, because I'm thinking of all the times, I've talked to him all the times, the two times that I've talked to him. And then I realized, oh no, it's Stephen Jenkinson. And yes, I've interviewed him on my podcast, but I don't really know him per se. He sat at a table like, so I'm in a booth this way. I'm facing my friends, this, who are in front of me, and he's in a table like two tables to my right. So I can see him in my periphery the entire time that I'm eating. And it's, it was like kind of awkward for me because I'm like, does he know who I am? Does he recognize me from our interviews? Probably not, because so many people in the restaurant knew who he was, and I could hear the like murmured rumblings about him. So I was like, he's probably just like staying focused on the people he was with. But I did not go over to the table and say hi because there was not a natural opening, and it just would have been so contrived and awkward. Like, he was having dinner with probably seven other people, and I think one of them was Andrew Huberman. Don't quote me on that. I can't guarantee it. And his back was to me after they walked in, but I'm pretty sure that's who it was. But it's like, it's a whole table of eight. So it's the same reason why, like, I pretty much never or very, 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 very rarely say goodbye when I'm leaving a party or group endeavor, because I don't want to pull the energy out of the momentum of the gathering so that I can all of a sudden hijack it and make it all about me leaving and therefore, threaten to shift the larger energetic of the party to like, oh, is it time to leave? Like, I don't want to do that. I want to honor the festivities and not do anything to like chip away at them with my departure. So I felt the same about Stephen Jenkinson. It's like he's at dinner with like seven or eight other people. They have their own flow. I'm not going to interrupt the flow and like hijack everyone's attention to me because I want to introduce myself to the famous person. So second time in a row that I was in the same room with Stephen Jenkinson and did not acknowledge him. And then I was like, am I being rude? Because I kind of know him, but is a podcast interview really knowing? In the grand scheme, it doesn't matter. I'm sure he has way bigger fish to fry, but I did have some misgivings like, should I? Should I not? It's awkward. There's not an opening. And I mean, I saw this so many times in LA, like the spazzy ways that people try to insert themselves upon the famous person's flow. And I didn't want to do that. So, Steven, if you're listening, because I'm sure that my podcast like tops your weekly listening list, I wasn't intending to be rude. I wasn't trying to ignore you. I was really just trying to honor the dynamic and the flow of what you had going. But I'm happy we got to break bread in the same restaurant. Okay, let me pause for a quick sip. I have three listed topics for us today. Where shall I start? Let's start with the Santa Fe stuff, the New Mexico stuff, because I've been talking about it for a while. And I think I might have mentioned that publishing my article in Estancia News would be the last that I'm talking about it. But if I did, then just throw that away because it's not. I'm currently writing the magazine version of the story. It's like there's so many tendrils of this. And I'm sure you guys know as you're hearing me talk about this, this is not relegated to Santa Fe. I'm looking under the hood. I'm seeing how the formula is working here, but I'm fairly certain that this is how it's working in every city. It's just easier for me to see here. And plus, we have the whole indigenous angle where I want to go with this. All right, let me give you guys the latest update and then we'll go into the meat of the matter. So, I think I told you guys last time that I know I did that the editor of the Santa Fe New Mexican got super hostile and hung up on me when I made the egregious, horrible offense of pitching him a story that is super relevant to the town that they allegedly cover. But they are part of the New Mexico, is it called the New Mexico Local Press Fund? I don't know. It's Omidyar's thing. I mean, there are just so many billionaire hands in what they have going on. We knew they weren't going to run it. So I did reach out to Estancia News and they did run it. So a bunch of people asked me, did they edit it? Did they ask for any changes? Guys, I really wish that journalism worked like that still, because I miss the days of having competent editors with whom I could collaborate to make my pieces better. And it doesn't work like that anymore. So they didn't pay me, which was fine. Like at this point, it's really just my service to humanity, to justice, to capital T truth. I have no illusions about making a living at being a journalist in this current propaganda, like ridiculous sham show climate. But The reason I bring that up is because they don't edit anymore. They don't, like, none of that is happening. Like, they just take what's thrown at them and they're like, is this ready to go? Fine, we'll put it up. And it sucks, but that's where we're at. And I'm not familiar enough with Estancia News to know if they were at some point operating in a way where their editors were collaborating with their writers. I'd like to think that. I just have no idea. So it's been great that it found a home. I mean, yes, Charlie Robinson put the article up on Activist Post, but I'm happy that it found a more local home. It'll be interesting to see, I don't know, what kind of sway it has, if any. But now I'm working on the narrative magazine version, which is way more fun for me because even when I started journalism school, like I already had a lot of like contraction and constriction around like straight, objective, all sides reporting. And I recognize that's how it's supposed to be, of course, but I'm more of like a gonzo kind of, you know, Hunter S. Thompson, Joan Didion, Tom Wolfe. Like I like to interject my point of view on things. At this stage of the game, with like everyone with an internet connection and like a fundamental command of like grammar and sentence structure, fancies themselves writers and like thrust their point of view on everything. So I don't want to be part of that. And just truth be told, like it for me, it takes a lot more discipline and a lot more restraint and holding back to just be like, these are just the facts, because there's a part of me that wants to contextualize everything. Like, you know, the activists making everything about them, right? Like you put up a statue and the statue is not seen as honoring the men it represents or the ancestors or the situation that is being positively honored. It's a slight against Indians, right? That narcissism I like to unpack. And so when I'm doing straightforward journalism, none of that is happening. It's like this happened, here's the date, here's the money, blah, 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 blah. And that's important. There's a place for that. And I'm really happy that I got to do that. But now I'm doing the fun one, which is like being more playful, inserting my two cents, and I'm taking some different angles because, like I said, it's so big. This is like, you know, a series. Everyone says it's a book. And honestly, guys, I don't know if I have it in me to do something as hard as writing a book. And I'm not saying that to program myself. I mean, Pop Propaganda, I did kind of like poop it out really quickly when they hit me with a bioweapon. But in general, I find writing books to be a lot of hard work. And then in this current climate, it's like, okay, so then I get to go, you know, chase pitch publishers. And it's just like, it's so much work when at this point I feel like I'm being called to do more promotion for the books that I've already birthed into the world instead of running off and writing a new one. But none of this is to say I'm not going to, knowing me. Who knows? But my point is just, I'm working on the magazine version of this article and I'm taking some different tacks and I'm examining, like, there's this group here, Vital Spaces, right? And who's funding them and why do they have the sway that they have over determining holidays, et cetera, et cetera. But I'm looking into, so part of what the activists have done, which kind of had me wondering how is this even happening and who's funding it because this can't possibly be organic, is the banning of the Entrada pageant. So for those who don't live here, don't know, and I'm gonna do my best to not get bogged down in too many details, Aquarius style, or bore you guys, because I certainly want all of us to be uplifted and inspired and entertained. So I'm gonna be succinct. The Fiestas de Santa Fe are the longest running annual celebration in this country, started in the 1700s, I believe 1711. So I just want that to sink in so that we understand that what is being attacked here is like foundational supportive architecture, not just for Santa Fe and the people of Santa Fe, but for this entire country, because remember, Santa Fe is the oldest capital city in the country. So that these traditions are honored and sustained is super important for just like the basic fundamental architecture of this whole country. So this is the longest running annual celebration in the entire country, and there's an aspect of it called the Entrada, which started to draw a bunch of controversy and was ultimately banned in 2018. Now, so the timeline that I'm working with is, wow, this mayor took office in 2018, and that's when all of these like attacks on Hispanic culture started to happen. Like, it's pretty Occam's razor to think there's a connection between him being installed and then this culture being erased. So I'm looking at it and I'm like, okay, well, yes, I can see where the activists who are totally bought and paid for by the billionaires who are using them, right? These billionaires do not care about indigenous sovereignty. They care about dividing and conquering us, and they care about getting access to the land and the water that these sovereign nations have separate from, like, the corporation that is the United States of America. So let's not pretend that, like, out of the blue, these billionaire industrialists who made their fortunes on displacing and fucking over Indians all of a sudden had a collective come to Jesus most moment at the exact same time, 2016, 2017, 2018, and just decided out of the kindness of their heart to devote millions and even billions and even trillions. I'm actually finding a trillion number crazy, to uplifting this formerly marginalized group of people. So, but I'm looking at this and I'm like, the controversy can't be entirely contrived by the billionaires. Like, I would guess that there's some indigenous elders or leaders who were also taking issue with the Entrada pageant. Now, the Entrada pageant that was banned was not like, hey, let's celebrate screwing over the Indians. It was about celebrating de Vargas's supposedly bloodless reconquest of Santa Fe in 1600 something, 17th century. And this is one of the fundamental like conflations of the victim mindset, which is like inherently narcissistic. And I know I just mentioned this a few minutes ago, where it's like the victim mindset doesn't understand that people can celebrate their culture, A, without thinking themselves superior or supreme to others. Like, we can have pride in our culture without thinking that people who have a different cultural background are inferior to us, right? Like, cultural pride does not necessitate superiority. But also, celebrating our history doesn't mean we're celebrating who got hurt along the way, right? That it's unfortunate, and I don't know how much of that is being acknowledged or not. It's really none of my business, but we can celebrate our heritage without being thrilled about the harm that took place in everyone's complicated history, right? So the Entrada pageant, which is a piece of the larger annual Fiestas celebrations, was a reenactment of de Vargas and his troop coming back into Santa Fe and reclaiming it from the Pueblo people. Now, war is ugly, war is violent, war is brutal. We know this, right? But as I understand it, and I've talked to a lot of people who are on the Fiesta Council and whose, you know, family's been on the Fiesta Council for multiple generations. It was never celebrating the harm done to the Indians. It was celebrating that their ancestors founded this place that we all call our home. And we acknowledge, yes, it is a complicated history, but we're happy to have Santa Fe. And this is what we're celebrating. Okay. So this celebration was banned in 2018. Now, as I said, it was only added to the larger, you know, hundreds-year-old consistent annual celebration in 1911, but that's still a long time to be having. It's over 100 years, this particular pageant, and then it was banned because the activists decided that it was like elevating colonialism and it hurt their feelings. And you know, one of the comparisons I make, we'll see if this stays, but in the article that I'm writing now is like, okay, growing up in LA, even though like I grew up in a, you know, San Fernando Valley was super Jewish, but I personally grew up in Van Nuys, which was like a Mexican barrio. But growing up, like every holiday, like season, the holiday season, it was Merry Christmas. It wasn't Happy Hanukkah. It wasn't Happy Holidays. It wasn't Season's Greetings. It was Christmas, 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 Christmas. And as a mouthy, bratty, rebel, contrarian little, Jewish American princess, I would get my little panties in a bunch about like Happy Hanukkah. So people would say, Merry Christmas. And I'd be like, and Happy Hanukkah to you, which was my little like not everyone's Christian. But what I say in the article, and again, this might come out, is like it annoyed me that there was no visibility for like my cultural practices, but it never occurred to me to lobby for the cancellation of Christmas altogether, right? And there's this other aspect of like the war and the brutality, blah, 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 blah. But I think it's a fairly accurate comparison in like the victim mindset of like, okay, I don't feel included, so this thing has to be canceled. Or this statue is triggering my philanthropy-funded indoctrination, so it has to come down, right? It's all this cancel everything out there so that we never deal with our own stuff and become actually sovereign and realized as human beings. But I was thinking, innocently enough, well, I bet there were some like real deal, indigenous and Pueblo elders who maybe did feel that this Entrada celebration was like rubbing salt into old wounds. Although even that, it's like we all carry epigenetic trauma, but at some point we have to take our power back from it. Everyone was enslaved, was killed, was, screwed over at some point in our genealogical history. Like, do we need to carry 300 and 400 and 500-year-old wounds into the present when, like, we personally, these versions of ourselves, had nothing to do with it? But here's what I found out, guys, is that it's still more bullshit. And that I looked into like the indigenous groups. I'm still pouring through them, but like, let's see, I wrote it down. All Council of Pueblo Governors was one of the biggest advocates for canceling the Entrada. They have received so many millions of dollars from the same old bad guys, from Seventh Generation Fund and Amalgamated and Ford Foundation and Annenberg and MacArthur. So it's like, oh my God, even these so-called Pueblo elders have been bought off by the same scumbags who are buying off the activists and trying to like pervert culture. So I just wanted to share that little piece, and I'm the journalist nerd in me is like, I kind of can't wait to finish recording the podcast so I could dive back in into the money trail and just see how gross and grimy it really is. But I just wanted to share that piece with you guys as I am continuing to dig into the story. Okay, so while we are on this story, I want to share another piece of the pie with you. So let me do a screen share. I'm trying to think where to start the story, and I do want to say I saw a meme recently about how Aquarians tell stories, and I felt so called out of like, wow, so many tangents and starting way too far back. And so, yes, I acknowledge that that's probably happening. Thanks for sticking with me. So, this is what I wanted to share, and then I'll give you the backstory. And this might not be the just right way to tell the story, and I'm okay with that. So, Governor Michelle Lujan Grisham, globalist scumbag, is the current governor of New Mexico. And this was posted maybe a week or so ago. I don't know the date. This is a tweet that she posted for those listening with their ears. New Mexico's multi-language heritage, spanning Spanish, English, and indigenous languages, is essential to the state's cultural identity and reflects the diverse communities that have shaped its unique character for centuries. Dolores Gonzalez Elementary in Barelas, I might be saying that wrong, Albuquerque's first dual language school marks its golden anniversary this week. Named after La Doctora, a pioneer of bilingual education in New Mexico, the school launched its dual language model in 1975. Today, nearly 60 APS schools offer dual language programs, reaching over 10,000 students, and it all started here. Students spend 50% of their day in English and 50% in Spanish, with research showing dual language learners perform 17 to 20% higher on standardized tests. All right, let's break this down. So, first of all, I agree, learning other language other languages is so great for training the brain to be nimble. And I fully believe that students who, can speak multiple languages, yeah, it's just like more brain exercise, right? It's like versus, just doing biceps every day versus like biceps and triceps and chest flies. And like we're gonna get different muscles activated. But I want us to see some of the comments here. English is the national language. Stop. Learn and get legal or leave. Stop ignoring America's heritage for a conquered land. And we're going to come back to these. Worry not. I'm about to contextualize. Here we have another one. I am a Spanglish Navajo speaking Hispanic, born, raised, and still in New Mexico. We do not all need to learn any other language, i.e., Mexican. We know you are speaking to the likes of your illegal Latino voters here in New Mexico, USA. We speak English. Get it straight. Okay. 50th in education, no matter how to spin it. Yes, we are last in education in the entire country. Here's where this is the meat of the matter. Someone, I don't even know how to, DKE back the blue resist socialism is their username, says a nation that doesn't have a common language that is taught in schools is doomed. This is the meat of the matter. We have another comment here. English, the national language. Okay, learn and get legal or leave. Indians agree. American heritage will never walk on conquered land as long as an Indian lives. All right, so the basic response to this announcement is like, this is ridiculous and this is woke pandering. And so I want to give us another example and then we'll get fully deeper into it. So, as I think I've shared, I was attending city council meetings this year. I took a break after doing the Zoom versions under COVID and realizing, like, oh, these are just like full-on tyrants who don't care about anything we have to say. But then I also recognize, like, with the censorship machine being so hardcore here, that it was really the only way to get things on the public record. Between you and me, I think I've lost the privilege of going to city council meetings because I don't like how I behave and I don't think it's helping. And as I'm diving deeper into the equity passage of my Sacred Honor Educational Fellowship law school program that I'm right now going through, I recognize that I've been acting kind of foolish at these meetings. And I'm also just like, there's something to walking the transformational path and like personal development of recognizing where we can improve and where we can get better. And also, I'm at the phase of recognizing like my real deal limitations and recognizing I am currently not in a place where I keep it together at the city council meetings. Invariably, I'm like misbehaving. So I'm taking a little breather from those. But I have attended at least two city council meetings where one of the city council people, Alma Castro, who is an avowed socialist, speaks only in Spanish. There's no translation. There's no translator there to translate what she's saying. She doesn't stop to, after she says whatever she says in Spanish, to do it again in English. There's a chance that I've spoken about this on this podcast before. So if I'm repeating myself, thank you for your patience, but I'm tying it into a new place. So stick with me. So I am someone who lives in Santa Fe. I'm not going to do the identifier, the citizen resident trap thing. I'm just going to say I live in Santa Fe. My allegiance is to Santa Fe, New Mexico. I attend these meetings because I want to have a positive impact on my community. When one of the city council members is speaking a language that I cannot understand, I don't feel included, right? This is the sect that's all hung up about inclusivity. Right? But she's speaking a language that, like, I'm not included at all. I have no idea what she's talking about. I know for a fact that not every city council member is fluent in Spanish. And I know for a fact that our mayor is also not fluent in Spanish. So, given that city council meetings, as I understand it, are places for the council and the entire city governing body to do business together, to move our city forward together. So if she's speaking a language that not everyone present can understand, then how is that functioning government? It is not. So what it is grandstanding. It's posturing, right? It's like, let me put on a performance because when I put this clip up on my TikTok, it's going to get a bunch of likes. So then we have, after I saw her do this, Grisham just announced this in the last week or two, this like pride in multilingual schools. And I believe I heard something, and apologies for not bringing the article, so I'm just paraphrasing, but I think they're starting to bring back the native languages that were kind of stamped out by, oops, by the then colonial powers. And to be clear, like, that's terrible. No part of me thinks it's okay that native tribes were prohibited from speaking their native language by those who colonized them. Like, that's totally not okay. But this is more than what, 400 years later, and now they want to bring those languages back. So on one level, like, cool. Like, I want people to be able to connect with their history, and if that's healing and empowering, that's wonderful. But the key was in that one comment that I read that this is yet another way to weaken and divide a nation for full-on authoritarian takeover. And this is the part that these like bought and paid for and thoroughly created activists, right? Because they're created by the billionaires who, for every nonprofit that they send a bunch of money to, and I did go over this in my last solo podcast, but they have these incubators, accelerators, cohort trainings, fellowships. It's all to train activists who then they're like controlling and bossing around. So I traveled through India for a few months in 99 and 2000. And it was super eye-opening, just I was traveling by myself, I got a one-way ticket, I was going all over and trying to figure out this like beautiful, exotic country. And so everywhere I went, I was, talking to people about like, why do you think India has the problems it has? Like, what do you think would solve the problems? And the consistent take that I got, which was, very eye-opening at the time, was because different parts of India have their own local languages, and not everyone in India is speaking the same language, understands the same language, they're never going to get it together. Because, say, you have like, and I don't even know the right terms, but if it's like a prime minister who's making an announcement in like Tamil, but then you have, an entire town or state that doesn't speak that language, they have no idea what's happening or what's coming down the pike. And it was, I feel like it's very telling to what's happening now that when I spoke to people about this, it was the most consistent answer that I got. We don't all speak the same language. We can't all understand one another. Therefore, we cannot unify and come together and decide what is best for Indians as a singular collective. And this is what they're pulling here. So, but I also agree. Like, I think Spanish is a beautiful language, and I love that people who are native Spanish speakers have pride in their language. I love if they're speaking it, with their people. But the fact remains that English is the national language here. And given that English is the national language, it's very Occam's razor. Well, let's all speak English in our civil servitude and our governance so that everyone can be included. But this has become so flipped around and inverted here. So they try to conflate people's issues with civil servants or anyone in these positions speaking only Spanish as like this racist, MAGA, anti-illegal immigrant thing, when really what it comes down to is, if we can't understand you, then why are you representing us? Like, and this is one of the primary issues I'm seeing in our, fake, god-awful government, is that these people who were supposedly elected, let's pretend, let's suspend our disbelief, right? And let's just go along with, like, yes, all these people were fairly and democratically elected to represent the people in their communities, right? In their district, in their city, in their state, in their county, in the country. That's the point of these representatives. And then you see these civil servants with all this attitude about getting criticized for speaking a language that the people they were, again, allegedly elected to represent can't understand. And the people with whom they're doing business, allegedly in service to the people, also cannot understand. Like, where's the controversy here? It's crazy to me. Like, that's great. You love social services, you love vaccines, you love sending a ton of money to foreign proxy wars overseas. Fine, that's great. We don't have to agree. But where are we not understanding that if official business is not done with a singular language that everyone can understand, then that's not going to be functional, effective governance? Like, I think a kindergartner could understand that. And it's yet another way that we have the globalist fucktards attempting to sow more division and chaos by inserting, like, it's now it's like the new hip woke thing to just speak whatever language we want, even though no one can understand us, because that's supposed to be inclusive. Like, I don't get it. Yeah, I think that's all I want to say about that, because I do think that I've spoken to this before, but to me, it's like so super basic. Yes, Spanish is a gorgeous language. Beautiful. There's no question. But if I'm at a city council meeting, then I want my city councilor who represents me to speak a language that I can understand. And I don't see why that's such a hard ask. Like, is that me being racist? I mean, according to the confused people, yes, but it's nuts. It's nuts that this is going on and they're doubling down on it right now. Like, if I have spoken about this before, and again, thank you for your patience as I have, this thing with the implementation of the restoration of these native languages and then the celebration of this bilingual school, this has happened since. And it's like, yes, if speaking Spanish is important because it's your family language or it's where you come from, wonderful. But the fact remains that we have one national language in this country, and that I don't think it's that much of a leap to expect everyone here to have knowledge of that language and to be able to speak that language and to do our official business with that language. It's like, I just don't understand the mindset behind this groupthink. But as I'm saying that, I'm remembering that groups, you know, I talk about this in my pop propaganda course, like group mind doesn't think. Group mind just responds and follows. And that's what we're seeing. And that's the danger of like this activist training, right? These emerge. So again, if I'm repeating myself, so be it. But Soros has this project here called Emerge, and Emerge trains women who want to go into politics or law in being like Marxist activists. And that's like, you know, when I was playing around with branding taglines, because as you guys know, as you're listening to me, like I do a lot of things. And I think, so when I was playing with marketing and all of that branding, root causes and solutions was kind of like what I kept honing in on, like whether it's through language or media literacy or, you know, journalism, quantum languaging, what I'm doing is I'm looking for the root causes and I'm proposing solutions. So through that lens, what I'm noticing is yet again, these NGOs, these philanthropists are the root cause of the problem. And by having these training schools set up, you know, the incubators, accelerators, cohorts, fellowships, blah, 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 trainings. That's the root cause of the problem because that's where they're infecting the minds of otherwise unwitting, innocent humans who don't realize that they're being conscripted into a woke army of globalists who, I can't overstate this, do not care about the so-called marginalized groups they're throwing so much money at, and they don't care about the activists that they're training. So I guess why I'm bringing this up is like root cause. Let's get the NGOs out of our country. You know, in the same way that I want to get VRBO and Airbnb banned from any city I'm living in, I want the NGOs out too. How about the only people who shape policy are the people who live in the city and like sentient people who ascribe to the values of the Constitutional Republic, I'd say we're living in, but thank you, Patriot Act, for fucking that up. But like, how are democratic socialists or straight up socialists running for and winning elected office in a country that's supposedly a constitutional republic? Like, why are we allowing that to happen? Like, if you want to be a commie mayor, you know, and implement Sharia law, do it in Cuba. Like, do it in China. Why would you do that here? But we know why, because everything's fake and gay. Someone called me in on that phrase, and I do appreciate that they asked. But they were like, "Are you using gay as a derogatory? Are you insulting gay people?" And I was like, "No, it's an established idiom within the truther community that speaks to the social engineering shaping our whole world." So, on the off chance that this is the first time you're tuning in and it's the first time you're hearing the phrase fake and gay, no, we are not deriding gay people when we're calling our social engineering strategies fake and gay. We're commenting on how our world is being socially engineered by psychopaths who hate the humans they're socially engineering. Okay, I think that's it for that piece. What's next on the list? Oh, I have it right here. Okay, so as long as we're talking about the propaganda machine, which maybe we're not even talking about, so maybe there was no integrity in that transition. Does it matter? No. Let's stay focused. The full frontal propaganda. So I first saw it, and again, I took a baseball bat to my television in my 20s, my early 20s, because I recognize like the toxicity of that programming and that conditioning. I do sometimes dip a toe into what they're pushing out on Netflix or Amazon just to get a sense of the propaganda du jour and, you know, what psyops they're trying to shove down our throats. So I didn't want to watch that terrible show, The Curse, with, you know, Queen Black Magic Satanist Witch, allegedly. Emma, whatever her name is. I don't even know. Whatever her name is. But she was in this show called The Curse that took place in Espanola, New Mexico. So I wanted to watch, like, okay, what's the propaganda around this? And it was so obvious about the like the whole native guilt thing. And I'm not sure if this is something that's going to make it to any of the articles I'm writing about this, but there is this organization here called Illuminative, which has a foot in Netflix and a foot in NBC Universal. And after Kellogg threw down like $2 million for their like Indigenous visibility project, all of a sudden Illuminative was getting like tens and hundreds of millions of dollars from like every philanthropy on the planet. So I'm guessing that they might have had a hand in that. But what I noticed in that show, I mean, I couldn't not notice it, was how many like tight penis close-ups they were shoving down my throat. And I thought, that is really weird. I don't even know if weird is the right word. I thought it was shocking. Now, granted, like, seeing so many like tight close-ups of dongs, not in pornography, but in like regular, alleged mainstream entertainment is obviously going to hit in a certain way, given that that has in the past been relegated to like pornography or the odd foreign film. But it's clear because I also tapped in a friend of mine, she texted me about some new show called Minx. And I was like, all right, I'll scope it out. I got about 15 minutes in and I'm like, this is thoroughly unwatchable. But in the first episode of that show, I must have seen like 30 tight dick close-ups. So I could see from one perspective where it's like, well, women are objectified and sexualized all the time, and we're always seeing naked women. So why can't we do the same with men? Which to me is like the same ridiculous go nowhere argument of like pushing makeup and nail polish on men. Like, oh, here's a way that we get women to like waste their sacred life force, their attention, and their time with like pointless vanity to make themselves eye candy for the rest of the world. But instead of like unindoctrinating women out of that program and saying, like, you have way better things to do with your time than waste, you know, half an hour every day painting your face in the mirror so you look a certain way that like Madison Avenue executives have just made up to bilk more money out of you. Instead of taking that tack, they're like, and men, you too can waste your sacred life force and time and attention with your own vanity by, you know, taking half an hour a day to paint yourself and metro yourself up. So I see that is what is happening with this full frontal propaganda. And actually, that might be the name for today's podcast, this full frontal propaganda. And I just want us to be real about it, and this is going to take me to my next and probably our final topic of the day, which is let's not cherry Mary sunshine what's happening. This is a full-fledged, full-frontal demoralization attack on us, where instead of allowing our bodies, our sexuality, and the act of sexual engaging between consenting adults to be sacred and private, we're now sullying it and making everything porn to demoralize our entire country, to lower our moral standards, right? Remember, demoralization is the very first step in ideological subversion, which I talk about all the time, which is Yuri Bezmenov's explanation and structure for how a country is taken over from the inside. And let us not kid ourselves. And I'm not saying this to inspire fear, because I do still think that love is already won and that we have way more power and ingenuity and creativity and will than the fucktards who are attempting to enslave us. But we are being taken over from within, which is why I'm putting so much effort into exposing this whole NGO thing, because it's one of the primary ways this is happening. And so I'm a little bit concerned by the like smutty, low vibe, pornographic nature of just our like average day-to-day entertainment, and how it has me wondering, like, yes, okay, there's the larger demoralization piece, but are they also doing that? And it's, I'm sure everything is a yes and. That does it for the first half of today's solo pod romp. As you are inspired to join me for the second half, please find me on both my Locals and Patreon communities. Those addresses are dannycats.locals.com and patreon.com/dannycats. At both of my membership communities, for as little as $5 a month, you get access to all of my second half conversations, plus oodles of bonus content, plus that awesome sparkly feeling that comes along with giving, with supporting others, with stepping into a value for value exchange wherein you enjoy and appreciate the content that I put out. And in exchange, you send me some cash, be it $5 a month, or $100 a month, or one-time donation of 50 grand. However you want to do it, it all works well. Also reminding you to sign up for my newsletter at dannykatz.com. It's the very best way to ensure we stay in touch. One last prod to click that like button, subscribe, share, comment, review. As you're wanting to boost your brain, your performance, and your mood, use the link in my show description to head on over to Brain Supreme, stock up on the very best brain boosting products with a super special ingredient that's probably not kosher for me to mention on the podcast. But once you go over to the website, I think you'll figure it out. When you're checking out, be sure to use code WORDUP, one word, all capital letters, so that you get 15% off of your order. And with that, I thank you for sharing your sacred attention with me and for remembering that every word matters and that you are omniscopic amazingness. I will see you over on the Locals and the Patreon tribe. Have a rockin' day.